Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions that you send to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. It's an opportunity for you, if you listen for the entire podcast, to, maybe find something relevant to your particular concerns. You never know what's going to come up during one of these Q&As with Layla. We get some excellent questions, and they cover the gamut of health and nutrition questions. So today with me, as usual, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. She's registered dietitian, and she also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition and vast experience counseling patients at the Hoffman Center, and before that at the illustrious Atkins Center, way back when, in the halcyon days of low-carb dieting. She was there in those pioneering days.
Yes, when we still had to be always on the defensive from the naysayers.
And look what's happened now.
And look what's happened, finally.
You didn't bet on the wrong horse.
Right.
Can you
right.
imagine if, like,
yeah.
15 years later or...
Oh, no, we were doing it all wrong.
It was wrong, but it's like people were dying, and it was, like, horrible, and now everybody's a vegetarian eating lots and lots of brown rice and beans. That actually didn't stand the test of time as well, although some people seem to be doing okay on that program. Certainly ketogenic diet, low-carb dieting, paleo diet, things that are, I think, sort
Whole
of
30,
out, they're
yeah.
outgrowths of the Atkins paradigm, and they've done very well. Before we get to questions, in the news today, something dismaying, and it's just so disappointing that, we just repeat the mistakes of the past. In Vietnam, we had Agent Orange. We had a lot of vets exposed to Agent Orange. And I actually was at the Veterans Administration in the years when soldiers, ex-GIs, military people would come to the VA hospital with all these mysterious symptoms. And they said, well, we don't really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then finally, they acknowledged that Agent Orange was the cause of their problems. So they actually got compensation for exposure to Agent Orange. Flash forward like 20 years later, the Gulf Wars, the wars of the 90s, where they had these enormous plumes of burning oil and, under the stress of combat and vaccines and all these things, people developed Gulf War syndrome.
Yeah.
Devastating illness, debilitating, kind of like chronic fatigue syndrome. Okay. Again, they said, well, this is psychological. They said these guys are just malingerers. They're looking for compensation. They're a bunch of sad sacks who, are trying to game the system. Well, it turned out, no, they really had a legit problem. Now, 2016, we think we've learned some lessons from the previous military engagements. Check this out. Headline. Iraq Afghan vets may have their own Agent Orange.
Oh.
Okay. What's this about? And I posted this on my Facebook account. Please follow me on Facebook for, pretty interesting stream of stories. I try to share with listeners what is relevant, I think, in the field of health. And, a lot of people suffer from environmental illness. But here's what they did. Burn pits. While it took nearly three decades for the U.S. government to eventually link Agent Orange, the defoliant used in Vietnam, to cancer, President Obama has pledged quick action to make determinations about the effect of the burn pits on perhaps as many 60,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. 60,000 troops.
Wow.
So what they did was they had these burn pits at U.S. military bases. Why? Well, I guess because, if you took the garbage out, you take the garbage out in your front lawn. Well, if you take the garbage out at a U.S. military base, you're liable to get hit with an IED or a sniper, right? Mm. So what did they do? They had a solution. Burn pits. So massive open-air burn pits at U.S. military bases that billowed toxic smoke and ash of everything from styrofoam and plastics to electrical equipment and even human body parts. They burned this up in a big pyre. Hey, doesn't it sound like World Trade Center? Like Ground Zero, 9/11?
Oh,
where
no.
all these people got exposed to these toxic fumes, and now they have cancer, they have horrible respiratory problems, weird cancers too.
Right.
And you remember that smell of the burning plastic that lingered for days
that
and weeks.
That very acrid smell.
I'll never forget that smell.
I don't either. I won't either.
Because it was it was burned building, mm-hmm. plastic, computers, mm-hmm. and people.
Yeah.
You know, and that's they have had one of the most notorious burn pits was in Balad.
Uh-huh.
Site of the largest and busiest airbase operated by the military in Iraq. It's now a ghost town. More than 10 acres in size.
Wow.
The pit burned at all hours and consumed an estimated 100 to 200 tons of waste a day. And it was constructed upwind from the base.
Uh-huh. Oh, my goodness.
Bad idea.
Terrible.
And its plumes consistently drifted towards the 25,000 troops stationed there. And now people are getting weird cancers. They profile a young woman who has two small children, who was a vet. She was with the Minnesota Air National Guard. She's, I think, 38 or 42. She's got pancreatic cancer.
Oh, no.
Whoa. What's up with that?
Well, that could be for a different reason, not necessarily that exposure, but...
But, yeah, who knows?
Whose idea was this?
Well, you know, as they,
That was their only solution.
They invented a term in World War II, called FUBAR.
Oh, I know that term.
You know what that term
yeah.
means? Okay. It means, roughly speaking, it means fouled up beyond all recovery.
Recognition.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's a military byline, is mm-hmm. that some of the decisions made in haste by the military are pretty dumb.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that sort of...
It's like the food that's offered to them. Not very good either.
Yeah. So...
Anyway. This is terrible.
Between that, the military diet, the stress, and, it angers me because...
Yeah.
This is a legacy that is, it's in some ways worse than the IEDs that blew people's body parts off. You know, that these people got this horrible, unnecessary exposure.
Because this was elective. It was elective exposure almost.
Yeah, well, it wasn't elective on part of the troops, but it was an avoidable,
right.
It was an unforced error. It wasn't caused by the enemy.
Yeah.
And look at the damage that it's inflicted on these people. Anyway.
Ugh.
So, that's my rant for today.
Oh.
Let's get to questions.
I wish them all the best in light of that. Anyway. On a positive note, we've got a nice email from a fellow integrative doc who writes to you, Dr. Hoffman, thank you for all of your expert guests recently, and thanks for the fantastic GERD review.
Good. Yeah, we did a three-part review in writing, and also we did a podcast on the subject of GERD, and I just mm-hmm. thought, and the theme of it was so many people are on these acid-blocking medications, and, you know, you've talked about this,
mm-hmm.
and I just did a lengthy series, detailing a protocol for getting people off those medications, including what mm-hmm. supplements, how gradually to taper, and certainly laying out the rationale for why we should be off these medications. I won't repeat it here, but please check out at drhoffman.com that three-part series and listen to the podcast because it's worthwhile.
PPIs are more dangerous than we knew.
Yeah, and all it's right. emerging, again, it's all this stuff is mm-hmm. emerging data, and we jumped feet first into... infatuation with these medications medically that now we're coming to regret.
It's true. Wow. All right. We've got a question from Cindy. We have a couple of questions from Cindy. I regularly drink kefir for its probiotics. Layla recently had a podcast which cited growth factors in dairy, and therefore dairy may be carcinogenic, if I remember the show correctly. Should I therefore try to eschew eating too much dairy? I was speaking on podcasts in the setting of breast cancer and how sometimes, not just in breast cancer, we do counsel our cancer patients to consider giving up dairy because of possible IGF-1 or
right.
insulin-like growth factors, mm-hmm. which may feed a cancer.
Right.
So, for those people who have cancer, yes, we tell them to consider giving up dairy, but
Particularly hormonal cancers.
Yes,
they're like a cancer like leukemia or something like that.
Right.
Maybe less related to hormones.
Yeah.
But there are hormonally driven cancers, which mm-hmm. are prostate cancer in men, breast cancer in women,
mm-hmm.
ovarian and uterine cancer in women. Maybe there's some hormonal influences on, is questionable, but, you know, colon cancer, perhaps.
Yeah.
Certain forms of lung cancer, even.
Right. I would say if you don't have to have a dairy source of probiotic, although dairy seems to be a really good delivery system, according to probioticadvisor.com, which is a very nice website. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, if you're going to have any dairy at all, rather than drinking milk or having ice cream, certainly, you're better off with a probiotic, you know, something that has its probiotics, your kefir or yogurt
right.
or something like that. But none of us need dairy.
Right.
We're the only animals on the planet who, after we're weaned from the breast, we continue drinking the milk
right.
now of different animals.
Right.
Did that just make you ill, what I just said? Or that idea make you a little, ooh.
Well, the way I put it is, you know, Stone Age men,
yeah.
you know, when we talk about the paleo diet, did not, hunt down a female antelope, tackle them, tie them up, and suckle at their,
teeth.
At their udders.
At their udders,
right?
Yeah.
You know, they just, but
yeah.
then eventually there was domestication. And hey, you know,
yeah.
the reason for these adoption of these things is that there was always a press for finding new calorie sources
yes.
because starvation was ever present. So if you could figure yeah. out, hey, wow, you know, you keep these animals in captivity and you milk them, it's like, hey, more mm-hmm. food, great, you know, it's calories.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, humans did not have the ability to digest lactose.
Right.
But they actually evolved. So this is in fairly recent times, you know, maybe, you know, 15, 20,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
the ability to digest lactose appeared probably somewhere in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
Where first they did, shepherding and animal husbandry.
Yeah.
Where they domesticated animals. It's a relatively new genetic modification.
Mm-hmm.
Some people don't have it.
That's
I recently
true.
Did a genetic analysis on myself,
uh-huh.
and it said I don't have a gene for lasting lactose tolerance. I actually have a lactose intolerance gene.
Hmm.
But part of that is it's a gene that is inducible, so it's kind of like use it or lose it. And nowadays,
right.
if I have like, you know, clam chowder is the decider. It always has to be Manhattan clam chowder for me.
Not New England.
Not New England,
which is
New
the
England, which
one.
I love, looks great,
yeah.
but like, man, that's going to be a quick trip to the men's room there if I, you know,
okay.
have a soup because
yeah.
it's full of lactose.
People wonder why when they give up dairy for a time, say a couple of months, then they complain that suddenly they're lactose intolerant. It's what you said.
Yeah.
The use it or lose it. When we don't use our lactase enzymes, our intestines stop really secreting them so we can actually become lactose intolerant, but you could slowly build it back up.
You can
again
slowly build it back. You know, this also happens, I think, in very dedicated vegans, for example. They may
yeah.
say, oh, I can't eat meat. It's so repugnant to me because whenever I eat it, it just sticks in my craw. And part of it
I
is.
I don't digest it. I
yeah,
can't digest it
yeah,
well.
They may
yeah.
have. These enzymes kind of respond to the circumstances of eating.
Yes.
And sometimes. You know,
they're not making enough proteases. They're not
right.
making enough protein
or lipases.
Enzymes. Or lipases,
right.
yes,
mm-hmm.
yes. Taking an enzyme supplement is helpful
right.
for something like that. But Cindy, you could drink your kefir if you wish. If you're somebody who may be insulin resistant or overweight or something like that, it wouldn't be my first choice because it will still have quite a bit of lactose. By the way, the whole raw milk thing,
I wanted to get into that.
Yeah.
There may be different effects of pasteurized versus raw.
Yes,
yeah.
because the lactase enzyme apparently is in the raw milk
mm-hmm.
to help digest the lactose,
yep.
which makes raw dairy more tolerable mm-hmm. to many people. But
right.
should we have that? I don't know. But I'll tell you, I have to be a responsible nutritionist. I'm a little bit conservative in this regard. If you're somebody who's pregnant, I'm not going to recommend you drink raw milk.
Brucellosis.
I'm afraid. Brucellosis, listeria,
yeah. mm-hmm.
all of that kind of thing. And
right.
I would steer you away from soft and raw cheeses as well. So, anyway.
However, in Europe, there is a tradition of doing this, and the French
yeah.
have really nailed it. They don't have a lot of
raw milk cheeses.
Disasters, but it's the very skilled cultivation of these raw milk products
yeah.
That you know, differentiates them from mass production where there may be some potential taint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cindy has another question. Actually, Cindy is 53 years old and she was just diagnosed with acute onset erosive osteoarthritis in both of her hands, painful and enlarged joints. Her rheumatologist said there's nothing to arrest the progression. Do you know of anything out there? What about naltrexone? I'm also on warfarin.
Warfarin. The Coumadin blood thinner.
Yes.
So, I hadn't really heard of this term, acute erosive osteoarthritis. Osteoarthritis is sort of a chronic condition. And I guess what they're saying is that she has bad arthritis that is not rheumatoid arthritis in her hands.
Painful and enlarged joints.
Yeah, sure.
Isn't enlarged joints rheumatoid, or is that?
Not necessarily. And it a little bit has to do with the features of a blood test, but it also has to do sometimes with the location, the typical location of the lesion. So a rheumatologist can classify this. Basically, this is, bad arthritis. So what? Nothing you can do? Yeah, there's something you can do. I mean, first of all, look at dietary factors, and I mean even dairy. And sometimes what we recommend is like a paleo style diet for somebody with a very acute inflammatory condition or an autoimmune condition. And I'm not saying that the dairy is the cause, but sometimes, and it's hard to know because I am increasingly losing my faith in blood tests for determining what foods one should eliminate or not. I think a trial of elimination is preferable, like.
Yes.
Trying the Whole 30, which is dairy-free, wheat-free, grain-free, something like that, just to see if you're better. So we often put patients on a paleo diet. Number two, lots of anti-inflammatories. We'll name some. UC2, I was going to call it ulcerative colitis. UC2, undenatured collagen type 2 would be very good for that. Take two at bedtime. The product is called Rheumashield.
I was going to say Modicare, but that's different.
Particularly good for osteoarthritis, but also rheumatoid arthritis. But then, lots of fish oil, higher doses of vitamin D, obviously.
Yes.
Curcumin.
Boswellin. Yes.
These are some of the things. Caprex is another product where we make a hops-derived product by Metagenics, I think. And
you could consider avoiding nightshades too for arthritis.
Absolutely.
The nightshade family of vegetables, these are tomatoes, peppers, all kinds of peppers, including cayenne and paprika, eggplant, white potatoes, tobacco.
Right.
People don't realize tobacco is a nightshade.
Probably more so chewed than smoked.
Probably.
But smoking is bad for you in so many ways. So the other thing, particularly for knee arthritis, niacinamide may play a role in as an anti-inflammatory, but it might play a role in hand arthritis. I think the dose is 500 milligrams twice or three times daily. So those are some things. But I think what a blind spot when a doctor says there's nothing you can do about it. It's just you're going to have this and you're going to be all deformed and all you can do is take prescription non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or steroids.
Wow. Cindy, best of luck to you. All right. We've got a question from Christina. Can you provide your opinion on the subject, and the subject is MSG in disguise? I see some online sources that warn people about MSG, that's monosodium glutamate, and tell them that companies disguise MSG under substitute terms such as yeast extract, maltodextrin. One source even contended that organic maltodextrin or organic yeast extract or organic red pepper are all surnames for MSG. Is this true? It can be. I was actually on a quest once looking for an organic chicken broth. I found something in a container. It said MSG free on the front of it.
Yep.
But when I looked at the ingredients, lo and behold, I see yeast extract.
The thing about all those ingredients is that they provide a sixth taste. I think the
umami,
which is discovered by the Japanese, but actually it's part of traditional Japanese cuisine. And finally, they did
it's food, a meat flavor.
They
like
did
a
that
smoky
food technology. Yeah, they used to use bonito flakes or something like that to create umami. I don't know, but which is a really tangy kind of flavor. And it's actually been shown to increase appetite. So hey, if you're dieting, that's not a great
thing. MSG increases appetite.
Absolutely.
Laboratory scientists, they fatten up their rats by feeding them MSG. It enhances gastric emptying. That's actually how MSG works.
Okay.
But different names for MSG. Christina, you're right. Here are some other names. Textured protein, possibly. These are possible sources.
Yep.
Hydrolyzed protein, definitely.
Yep.
Sodium caseinate, calcium caseinate, autolyzed yeast, vegetable gum seasonings, carrageenan. My favorite is natural flavorings.
Carrageenan imparts MSG or just a bad thing in itself?
It's just a bad thing in itself.
Yep.
It can cause digestive issues for those with already compromised guts.
I think that's the caveat. I am not per se against anything that has carrageenan.
Yeah.
I just am, because I have to say that you know, some people are nutso when it comes to anything that has carrageenan. If you don't have ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, or leaky gut syndrome, and you're well, you can tolerate a little bit of carrageenan.
Yeah.
It's just when you have breached your barriers, protective barriers of your gastrointestinal tract, you have ulceration or inflammation, that's a problem. Now, it's a problem in so many people that maybe it's a good idea to steer clear of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the cross to the vampire kind of thing that some people think.
That's true. That's true. Some people do just fine with it and others not at all. I've heard situations where somebody would have some MSG by accident. They have a headache for 2 days
mm-hmm.
or something like that. Other symptoms that can be caused by MSG, cramps, gas bloating, reflux.
Absolutely, reflux. I include that in my article
mm-hmm.
on GERD. Is you really have to be careful about MSG ingredients because it can inflame the guts. I've actually seen some cases where we took people off MSG and that did the trick.
It really does. It really can do the trick. Other places where you'll find MSG, smoke flavorings, bouillon.
Yep.
Barley malt, malt extract. These are actually sources of gluten too. Possibly soy sauce or extract.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, Christina, they can masquerade, and my favorite is natural flavorings, because who knows what that is
right.
at all. So
yep.
MSG can go by different things. Unfortunately, Food and Drug Administration still insists that they don't necessarily have to name it.
Right.
That's unfortunate.
They call these weasel words.
Yeah.
Weasel words for MSG.
Right. But. Thank you for your question. Okay. We've got an email from Gail. Hello, good afternoon to both of you, Dr. Hoffman and Layla.
How does she know we're recording this in the afternoon?
I don't know.
Maybe it's the
she's guessing.
For her. No,
maybe it's the
her
afternoon for her. She's listening in the afternoon. I have recently been diagnosed with diverticulosis. I'm researching which foods to avoid, which ones to eat. However, I'm getting a lot of conflicting inflammation.
Right. She's probably getting some conflicting inflammation.
So, I sincerely appreciate your advice and program. Well, diverticulosis is pretty common. A lot of people over the age of 50, or diverticulosis rather, is pretty common,
right.
Especially over the age of 50.
Right. So, exactly. It is mm-hmm. Diverticulosis, let's distinguish it from diverticulitis.
Yes.
You cannot have diverticulitis without diverticulosis. It's mm-hmm. a predisposing factor for having an infection of one of these outpockenings of your intestine. Diverticulosis is merely the anatomical finding, which they'll tell you about when they do a study. Maybe they'll do a colonoscopy or they'll do a barium enema or a CT scan or an mm-hmm. MRI, and they'll say, oh, you have diverticulosis, which mm-hmm. is actually probably, you know, it's as common as hiatal hernia. It's a finding that you see in most people over 50, especially people on a Western diet. You know, if you've been on an exceptionally good diet and you don't have it, it's like you actually are an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to not, in America, to not have diverticulosis.
Mm-hmm.
So having diverticulosis, per se, is not the problem. It's when you have diverticulitis that's a problem. So what do you do for diverticulosis is that you...
Follow a high-fiber diet.
Yes.
You want to make sure you don't become constipated.
Yep.
I actually wrote about this briefly in the newsletter, but the high pressure that happens in the bowel is what can cause
these
outpocketings.
It's literally like, you know, when you're lifting a weight, you're going, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, that's a pain and there's a bulge in your groin.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hernia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many people are familiar with that sensation. But that actually, you can get a herniation in your colon from the pressure, the continuous pressure buildup.
Right. Right. So if you were told of diverticulosis, there really isn't anything to do because you won't really have any symptoms. Just follow a good high-fiber diet.
Yeah.
So that's essentially it. Diverticulitis is an acute situation most of the time, which may require a doctor visit, a hospital stay, possible not eating anything for a couple of days.
Bowel rest, antibiotics.
Yes, you would feel it. It mm-hmm. can be excruciating. So, yeah.
And ultimately surgery, mm-hmm. you know, if the area is too damaged, you know,
exactly.
if it's beyond healing.
Exactly.
Because it's kind of like, it becomes like a bad tooth. It's chronically infected mm-hmm. and, you know, the outpocketing is all inflamed and it's like appendicitis, you know.
Yeah.
Appendicitis is actually it's an anatomical diverticulum.
Right.
The original diverticulum, which actually has functions. It has immune functions. It mm-hmm. has lymphoid tissue. And there's some suggestion that people get more certain diseases when they have their appendix taken out because mm-hmm. it performs a function. It's a reservoir for beneficial bacteria. But, okay, that's another subject. We're out of time for part one. In part two, what are we going to tackle?
Nanobacteria in artery plaque.
All right. We'll explore that intriguing theory in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin, Hoffman Center nutritionist.